Okay, you can start that going around. Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bible 241, and it's the 10th of February, Thursday. We were supposed to have a test today, but it got rescheduled earlier in the week until Tuesday of next week. So hopefully nobody's surprised by that. If you are, then you got to keep coming to lecture, because that's when we announce those things or listen to the lectures. All right, so last time we were talking about organelles, so we're in the cell chapter. So what's the building block of life? The cell, yeah. The structural and functional unit of life is a cell. If something is alive, it's got to be cellular in nature. And what are the three things that make that define what a cell is? You got to have these three things in order for it to be a cell. Plasma membrane, number one. Cytoplasm and genetic material. That's right. So cytoplasm means that there are active chemical processes taking place inside the cell membrane. So then what's the building block of a cell? Maybe you have to go back to anatomy. Oh, building block of a cell. So building block of life is a cell, but what's a building block of a cell? Molecules. That's pretty good, but that's a little bit too small, the way I'm thinking. The building block of a cell, at least for our kinds of cells, not for bacteria, but for eukaryotic cells that humans are made of, and I think I heard it over here someplace, are organelles, right? So we put a bunch of organelles together, then we have cytoplasm that functions in our typical kinds of cells. So that's what we were talking about, organelles. All right, so what's the job of an organelle? It performs a special function, a particular function. So you got to know the names of all the organelles and what their particular function is, right? All right, so we were talking about a number of them. So at least you should have some good bullet point understanding of organelles, like mitochondria makes. And, but we're going to spend a couple weeks, maybe a month, looking at what a mitochondria really does. But for now, that's great, makes ATP, right? Okay, ribosomes, which is where we left off. Oh, let me turn some of these lights down. See if I get a weird feedback as I move over here. I want to turn these off and these off right here. Hopefully that's a little bit better. Okay, ribosome. You should know what a ribosome is responsible for. It is protein synthesis, and a little bit later in this chapter we're going to see there's two important steps for protein synthesis, and it's the second step of protein synthesis. But without that second step, then you don't make a protein, so you can just say protein synthesis for right now. So ribosome is extremely small. Oh, I got to get my cursor defined right here, so hold on. Otherwise, it's going to keep disappearing. Okay, so here is a ribosome. It's extremely small. So this is a nice model representation, a computer model of a ribosome. And it has two subunits that come together. But what do you notice about this ribosome right here? Other than it's kind of spherical, but what else? It has an interesting structure. It has a tunnel going through it right here. So there's a tunnel. And another kind of RNA is going to process through this tunnel right here. And when it does, then we get that second step of protein synthesis taking place. So the ribosome is the workbench where a protein will be assembled. We're going to look at that in just a little bit. So ribosomes we can see in two different areas with inside the cell. It can be associated with endoplasmic reticulum, converting it from smooth ER to rough ER. And so now you kind of know what the function of rough ER is protein synthesis, because it has ribosomes. Okay, if we have endoplasmic reticulum without a ribosome, cannot make proteins, but it is involved with lipid synthesis. It can make phospholipids, and it can make steroids. So that's its particular function. All right, Golgi complex, you should probably have at least two words that describe its function. It receives vesicles from smooth endoplasmic reticulum, and inside those vesicles there are the product of the rough ER, which is what? Proteins. So proteins from rough ER end up in the Golgi apparatus, because those vesicles then fuse to that membrane, and now those proteins are inside the Golgi apparatus, and then they are modified. They could be conjugated with another molecule. That means another molecule could be added to it, like a sugar molecule or a lipid. If it's a sugar molecule, then we have something called a glycoprotein. And if it's a lipid molecule, then it becomes a lipoprotein. And it has different structures, different kinds of activities. And then after it's modified, that modified protein or conjugated protein is then packaged in another vesicle, which then gets shipped to the plasma membrane. And that vesicle that gets over to the plasma membrane, then we call a secretory vesicle, fuses with the plasma membrane, and the interior contents of that secretory vesicle get exocytosed into the extracellular fluid. All right, so this is what we consider a secretory pathway. Great. All right, so I think we did talk about some other vesicles inside the cell, like a lysosome. What would you, just a quick review, a lysosome is responsible for digestion. A peroxisome is important for detoxification, right? And an endosome is responsible for routing of various membrane components. So you could say routing. All right, so they're routers. Okay, so here's the nucleus. All right, and as we talk about all these different functions of organelles, since they have different functions, and of course you would expect that they have a little bit different shapes, right? There's always that structural function relationship. You should think, why does a cell have all these organelles? So kind of think of that in the back of your mind. I don't think I mentioned that yet. So here is a nucleus, and there's a membrane around the genetic material inside the nucleus. Usually, if this is an interphase where the cell is building various cytoplasm components, or where there is DNA replication taking place, or protein synthesis has been initialized, there's a dark area that we call the nucleolus. That's the active part of the nucleus. And this is where a type of RNA is being made, ribosomal RNA. But that's just consider that the active part of the nucleus. So if you see a nucleolus, you know that's a nice, healthy nucleus that is very active at that particular moment. So the membrane around the genetic material protects the genetic material from all the other processes that are happening inside the cell, because that genetic material defines what that cell is going to look like. It's going to define all of the molecules, the shapes of those molecules, how proteins are put together, which then define how a cell is going to be functioning. And without that information, the cell has to die. So we don't want corruption of any of that information inside the nucleus. It's protected by the nuclear envelope. So it's a barrier, and then there are some channels that we call pores that allow small molecules to enter or leave, but large molecules like RNA usually have to be transported by active transport mechanisms. Okay. So let's talk about gene expression. Oh, we didn't finish up on that one point. Why do our cells have all of these organelles? I mean, it's cool because they have all these nifty functions. Some make ATP for us, and others make lipids, other things in there make proteins. Others modify things very nicely. But why do we have all these different organelles? What's a nice way of putting that model in your mind? Yeah, it's necessary for life, but think of a cell as this building right here. And when you walk in the front door of this building, what do you see? One big room that's like three stories tall, that goes all the way to front to back. But when you walk in this building, what do you see? You see a bunch of rooms. So why do we have different rooms in this building? And it's kind of analogous to why a cell has different organelles. Let's just say there was only one big room in this building. Well, I think that would be pretty cool because we could all graduate with a degree in one semester, because we could take a physics class and a physics lab and a physiology, anatomy, microbiology all at the same time, because you just walk into one room and you would hear all those lectures at one time. That'd be really efficient. How come no one's thought of that before? Wow, we just discovered how to get through college in one semester. Just build one big building. And maybe you could even get a couple degrees at one time. Maybe an English degree, right, as well as a science degree all at one time, because all those lectures are going on at the same time. Oh, but do you think it would work or not? Probably not. Because one lecture would interfere with another one, so everything going on would interfere with each other, right? So a building has rooms in it, so specialized functions can take place at the exact same time without what? Without interfering with each other. So that's why a cell has organelles. So that ATP synthesis can take place, like you know where, can take place along with protein synthesis, you know where that happens, right, where lipid synthesis takes place, right, all at the same time without interfering with each other. So that's just specialization of all those little compartments within a cell, so everything happens in a nice orderly fashion without competition and hurting each other's processes. All right, so that's the important reason for organelles. All right, so let's talk a little bit about gene expression. And maybe we could have a little arrow pointing straight down from gene expression down over here. And what does, when we express a gene, on the tip of that arrow down here, what should we draw or what should we write down? What is a gene expressing or what is made when a gene expresses itself? Yeah, traits. And then, but how is that, what is the physical entity of that trait? It is a protein. Okay, so it's a protein. So gene expression produces proteins, and the particular shapes of those proteins then will produce a particular trait. So what you said is exactly right. I was just thinking a little bit molecular, right? I was thinking of a protein. All right, so gene expression. Where do we have genes? Genes are, they're found in DNA, right? And so DNA makes up chromosomes, and you know chromosomes are found in the nucleus. So we're going to look at some nuclear events first. All right, but since we're concerned with protein synthesis as gene expression, let's now define what protein synthesis really is. And to do that, we want to go back to a very old circumstance that we taught students long, long time ago, okay? And we taught students not to question this. And so it's not really a theory. This is something that's not in your book, all right, but this is an old slide that I'm showing you. So whenever you're taught something and you're supposed to behave or think in a certain way without questioning, we call that a dogma, right? But in science, what are you always taught? You're always supposed to question. Question authority. Question everything, right? Make sure that you have your information right. So anyway, this is a good place to start, even though you should question it. All right, so information will flow from material that we call DNA into material that we call RNA, and then finally that information flows into a protein. So how many arrows do you see in this thing that I'm trying to make sure you never question? How many arrows do you see? You see two. So how many processes are there in protein synthesis? Yeah, there are two processes, right? So the first process is the conversion of information in DNA to RNA. And the second process is the conversion of that information from RNA into a protein, right? And what about those, the connections between RNA and DNA? Is it a two-way street or a one-way street? It's a one-way street, right? Information flows from DNA into a protein. Information in proteins never flow back into DNA and change who you are, right? So you don't have to worry about going home and having chicken dinner tonight and worry about waking up in the morning tomorrow with feathers and a beak, because that just won't ever happen, right? Because that protein that you eat cannot change who you are. Okay, so it's a one-way street, two-step process. All right, now where does this first process take place? And a good way to analyze that is to realize, where is DNA always located? It's protected inside the nucleus. So this first step happens inside the nucleus. Right, and then RNA is made, and then RNA leaves the nucleus, and it enters the cytoplasm. So the second step right here always happens in the cytoplasm. So that's some important take-home information. The first step happens in the nucleus, second step happens in the cytoplasm. And since these two steps are a little bit different, do you think it would be a good idea to have different names for them so that we could talk about them and know what we're talking about? Sure, it would be a really good idea. Okay, let me see what the next slide is. Oh, we talk about these two steps, but maybe I'll just stay on this slide right here. Okay, you know what the building block of DNA is. What's the building block of a DNA? And you have to recognize that on the test because you have that flash quiz. You have, yeah, you have a nucleotide, right? That's pretty good. That's a good place to start. What's the building block of RNA? It's a nucleotide as well. The nucleotide is what? Just a little different. The nucleotide for DNA is what? A deoxyribonucleotide, and the nucleotide for RNA is what? Just a plain old ribonucleotide. Only different by what? One little simple oxygen molecule in that whole big molecule, which to me doesn't seem like a really big deal. Seems like a really small deal. It's a small change in shape, but guess what? It's a big change in the function because the shape has changed a little bit. All right, so the building block of DNA and RNA is the same. Let's just say it's the same because it's different by so little. So what happens when you take some information and you make like a photocopy of it? What is that process called? You could look that up in the dictionary when I tell you the word. But a good example is, say, you've taken a lot of classes here at Cypress College, and your record is over in administration and records, and now you want to apply to another college or a job, and they want to see, hey, what kind of classes you took, what kind of grades you have. And you ask for a transcript. And a transcript is what? Just a photocopy, and it's an exact duplicate of what's in administration and records. So this first step right here is what we call transcription. Right, because the language of DNA and the language of RNA is exactly the same. It's just really a photocopy. So we call that transcription. The beauty of that system is that if RNA gets damaged in the cytoplasm, the cell doesn't die, because where does that information still reside? It still resides in the nucleus, and if you want to get another working copy of it, you can just transcribe it again. So that's the beauty of the nucleus and this first step right here. So transcription happens where? In the nucleus, right? Okay, this second step over here, from RNA to protein, the RNA has to leave the nucleus, goes into the cytoplasm. Now, tell me, what's the building block of a protein? Amino acid. What's the building block of RNA? Nucleotide. Sounds like a different language to me, and indeed it is, right? The language of RNA is what? Nucleotide language. The language of proteins are amino acids. What do we call that process when you take information from one language and convert it to another language? That's translation. So then you could fill in this arrow right here. Translation, all right, is the second step, converting information from RNA to protein. All right, so that's like converting information from Farsi to Mandarin, right? What about the information content? Is it lost? Is it changed? No, the information is exactly the same. It's just the language is different, right? So there should be high fidelity in that translation process. Okay, and that happens in the cytoplasm, because where is a protein made? Give me the organelle. Ribosomes, and where do you find ribosomes? In the cytoplasm. Either free ribosomes floating around in the cytosol or on rough endoplasmic reticulum. Okay, so that's what this slide pretty much describes. Protein synthesis is a two-step process. Transcription is this first step that always happens inside the nucleus. We call that transcription. And it just converts information in DNA to RNA to make a working copy of that information. Then RNA leaves the nucleus to the cytoplasm someplace. And then on a ribosome, some forms of RNA, namely messenger RNA, is used as a dictionary to spell out a protein using amino acids. Right, and so going from a nucleotide language to amino acid language, we call that translation. Okay, and a protein is just a linear, what's a protein? Here it is. All right, a linear sequence of amino acids make up what? A protein, and a linear sequence of nucleotides is messenger RNA. So there's going to be a nice direct relationship to just a linear sequence of nucleotides and messenger RNA, which determines a linear sequence of amino acids that make up a protein. That happens on a ribosome. Okay, so where that information resides safely is in a gene. So genes are lengths of DNA that will code for the synthesis of RNA, right? And in particular, messenger RNA, and then messenger RNA leaves the nucleus and it carries information on how to make a protein, right, on a ribosome inside the cytoplasm. So that's what we call gene expression. It's got those two steps. So the first step is activating the DNA to make it available for what process? What's the first process called? Transcription. That's a very important step, because you don't want to be producing all of the many thousands of kinds of proteins that your chromosomes can produce. Only the certain ones that you need at a particular time. So it's under a lot of regulation. Okay, so don't forget, here's the slide that's in your book, transcription and translation, but hopefully now you got a pretty good feel for those two terms, so it won't be so confusing. Just don't memorize it. If you don't have a good understanding of transcription and translation, then just look it up in a dictionary. Okay, think about it a little bit, or Google it, do a little Wikipedia, and figure out what those two things are. Okay. All right, then we talked about the nucleolus already. That's the active part of the nucleus that's making ribosomal RNA. Ribosomal RNA is the RNA that's actually used to make a ribosome, that spherical structure that has that tunnel going through it. Okay. So if we think of all the genes that are contained in your chromosomes, then we can give that an entity. We call that the genome. So the genome refers to all the genes in an individual, or maybe you want to expand that definition and think of all the genes that might be in a certain population. Right? Because my genes might be a little bit different than your genes, but they're still human genes if they're in you, so let's include them in the genome as well. Okay, and what does a genome produce? What does gene expression produce? Yeah, proteins, right? And then it will, you can then think of that as being traits, but it produces proteins. So if you think of all the proteins that can be produced by the genome, then we call that the proteome. So the proteome is just all the many thousands of kinds of different proteins that can be produced by the information in your chromosomes that we call the genome. Okay, so we'll probably use those terms. So here we see some DNA, and we got two different kinds of DNA on this slide. We see some DNA right here, right, and that's making up a chromosome. And this chromosome is ready to undergo mitosis. It has been replicated. We call that a chromosome, but there are actually two copies of a chromosome when we see it in this like X configuration right here. So here is one chromosome, and then here's the other one that's exactly identical to it, and they're connected together right here at the centromere, and the proteins that kind of hold it together, we call that the kinetochore. Okay? Now, the DNA that's tightly packaged like that, that we can actually see underneath a microscope, is not in a usable form. It can't be used by the cell. Right? It's just too tightly packaged. So in order for a cell to get at the information in DNA, it has to be unwound from a chromosome. So there are two kinds of DNA. There is what we call extended DNA that we cannot see, or extended chromatin that we really can't see underneath a microscope, or condensed chromatin that we can see very nicely as a chromosome. So it has to go back and forth. The way it goes back and forth is that it's packaged, it's wound up on some protein molecules that we call histones. Right? And histones have a little bit different charge. The DNA has a negative charge, the histones have a positive charge, so they attract each other, right? So it can be nicely packaged. And so you can see in a chromosome that it's a very long string of DNA, because first you have coils around a couple of histone proteins, and then, so that's what we call a nucleosome, and then a number of histone proteins can be stacked on top of each other, and then these stacks of nucleosomes can be wound up, right? And then it can be even wound up even tighter to make a chromosome. So it can take huge length of DNA and wrap it up into something that's really short and small. As a matter of fact, if we were to take all the DNA in our body and extend it from end to end, and then connect all the ends up together, you have an idea how far you could reach, how long of a rope that would be? Now, it's really thin, microscopically thin, but it would be about 250,000 miles. Anybody have a good idea what 250,000 miles is? That's about how far the moon is. Okay, it varies just a little bit, but that's how long that information is. It's a huge string of information, but don't forget you have a lot of cells in your body. So not every cell can go to the moon, but if we take all the DNA out, it would stretch to the moon. Okay, so that's how DNA works. If it's extended, then we can get at the base pairing inside the double helix of DNA, but when the nuclear envelope disappears, this information has to be packaged very nicely into a chromosome so it doesn't get damaged. But when it's in a chromosome, then it can't be used. So what process, where, in what phase of the cell cycle do we see chromosomes, where the chromatin is condensed like this into a chromosome? You probably know that from anatomy. And that's the very last part of this chapter, which I'll mention, but we probably won't go into it in a lot of detail. But that is mitosis. Okay? And what happens during mitosis to the nuclear envelope? It breaks down. Right, so if the nuclear envelope breaks down and you have extended chromatin, then it can be damaged, and that's going to kill the cell. So before mitosis can take place, chromatin has to condense into chromosomes like this, right? And it's packaged safely. All right, so basically we have a couple different kinds of chromatin. Euchromatin is extended, that's the active part. Transcription can only take place on chromatin that is extended, or euchromatin. Heterochromatin is highly condensed, where genes may be permanently inactivated, right? But it might be temporarily inactivated as well, like in a chromosome. All right, but if it's heterochromatin that's highly condensed, can it be used for anything? Can it be used for transcription? Nope. So think of, maybe you're going on a vacation, probably not this weekend, but say next weekend after the test. Okay, you're going to go to Florida. So what are you going to take with you? You're going to take your regulator with you, your fins and a mask, toothbrush, right? Maybe a wetsuit. What else would you like to do? Golf clubs when you go to Florida. Tennis racket, clothes, maybe you go out for dinner, you want to take some nice clothes too. So you walk on to an airplane with all those things in your arms. What would happen? Well, you'd lose half of them before you get to Florida, right? So what do you do with all your belongings before you go on an airplane? Put it in a luggage, okay? But when it's in a luggage, can you use your regulator or your toothbrush? No, right? So when things are packaged nice and safe so you don't lose them, you can't use them. But they're safe. And as soon as you want to use them, what do you got to do? Take them out of the luggage, and then what can happen? Like your sunglasses. Well, then you can lose them, right? So think of the nuclear envelope as performing the same kind of function and what chromosomes do, right? It just packages the chromatin so that it's nice and safe. So here we see a superstructure of various nucleosomes. So this is what we call condensed chromatin. But in order for it to be used for that first step of protein synthesis that we call... What's that first step called? Transcription. In order for transcription to take place, it has to be extended. All right? And controlling that process is a process called acetylation. Acetylation is when we take a two-carbon fragment. We're going to look at some carbon fragments. An acetyl group is just two carbons put together like this. All right? When an enzyme takes that two-carbon fragment and starts to apply them in different locations to this condensed chromatin, it starts to unwind. And when we say unwind, what does that mean? It means it becomes extended, means it can become damaged, but what else happens? It can become useful. It can be used for transcription. So acetylation causes unwinding of chromatin into an extended form. So now we have long segments of DNA, which can then bind various factors in certain locations, and when the right signaling molecule binds to this DNA, then transcription can begin in this location right here. All right, so then if transcription can take place on this DNA, what's going to be produced? If transcription happens right here, so all of a sudden transcription starts and it starts to walk down this DNA molecule, as it's walking down, what's being produced? RNA in particular. Good, that's a nice step for you to take. So RNA is going to be made at this location. So two things have to happen before RNA can be made. The acetylation has to occur. You have to have extended chromatin, and a transcription factor has to bind to a DNA molecule. And then when your cell has enough of that particular protein, guess what? There's feedback back into the nucleus, and then it puts this gene away. How's that gene put away? Then those two carbon fragments are taken off of these molecules right here. We call that deacetylation, and when that happens, this thing starts to supercoil again. It's nice and packaged, but then it can't be used for transcription. But if all of a sudden your cell needs information in this gene, what does it do? It acetylates that area, okay? Or the transcription factor binds, and we can make some more proteins. Okay, so acetylation and deacetylation are ways to either condense or extend chromatin so that it can be active. All right, so RNA synthesis. One gene codes for one polypeptide chain, right? That's what we believe for a long period of time. And each gene is several thousand nucleotide pairs long. So what do we need for transcription? Well, transcription, we want to make RNA. There has to be an enzyme, and an enzyme, we're going to look at enzymes, I think, in the next chapter. If we see a word with an ASE on the end of it as a suffix, that usually means that it is an enzyme. It's going to catalyze some kind of activity or chemical reaction in the cell. And let's talk about polymer. What's a polymer? It's a molecule that is made up of repeated building blocks over and over and over and over again. Like starch is a polymer. The building block of starch is glucose, right? A protein is a polymer. Its building block is, or are, amino acids over and over and over and over again. Nucleic acids are polymers. Their repeating unit over and over and over and over again is deoxyribonucleic acid if it's a DNA nucleic acid, or ribonucleic acid if it's an RNA molecule. Okay, so that pretty much defines this whole term right here. RNA polymerase is an enzyme that makes a polymer that we call RNA. What are the building blocks that RNA polymerase needs? The ribonucleotides, right? Not the deoxyribonucleotides, but just the ribonucleotides in order to make an RNA molecule. So RNA polymerase binds to a start sequence on DNA and unzips the strands. Because what can you tell me about DNA? Let's go back. Ooh, I had to go back a lot of slides. It is always double-stranded. Okay? DNA is always double-stranded. So it unzips. Is that a really terrible, hard thing to do? What's holding those strands together? Just hydrogen bonds, so it's pretty easy to unzip. Okay. There are nearby promoter regions which regulate levels of transcription because those promoter regions have to bind transcription factors. And some of those transcription factors might actually be hormones that we're going to look at a little bit later on. So a transcription factor has to bind to that promoter region to initiate transcription, which means what? Then the RNA polymerase can start to do its job. It unwinds the DNA and then starts to undergo transcription. So how does that work? So here we have a double-stranded nucleic acid, which is DNA, right? And you also know this is DNA because of where I'm pointing right here. What do you see right there? Yeah, so you see the base pairing rules. You got GC and AT, and whenever you see a T, which is thymine, then you know it's DNA because RNA does not have any thymine in it. What does RNA have instead of thymine? Uracil. Okay. All right, so the RNA polymerase binds, it unzips the DNA molecule, and then it starts to add, by base pair rules, the ribonucleotides. And it uses one strand as a template for making a copy of that DNA. Right? Like if you ever were to sew anything and you want to make 50 of one kind of shirt, what's the easiest way of doing that? Buy a template so that all of the basic building blocks of that shirt will have the same dimensions, right? So here is the template for making a messenger RNA, or maybe even a ribosomal RNA. So here we have an A in DNA. What's going to bind to adenine in DNA? If it is a RNA molecule, it's going to be uracil, right? And what will base pair with guanine? In RNA, it will be a cytosine, right? And then another uracil will base pair with adenine and DNA. Here's a cytosine in DNA. What's the RNA base pair for that? That's going to be guanosine. So here we have now a nice RNA molecule that's single-stranded. There's going to be a stop sequence. When the RNA polymerase reaches that stop sequence, then it will unbind from the DNA molecule. It will cut loose the RNA, and then the DNA molecule will zip back up together again. Okay, but this is nice and protected because where do we find it? We don't have to worry about breaking a DNA molecule. If we break that DNA molecule, that's bad. Right? We need to have a nice continuous DNA molecule, never broken, because that might kill the cell if it breaks. Okay, so where is this process happening? Inside the nucleus, when the nuclear envelope is nice and healthy, protecting all the stuff that's going on right there. Okay, so that is transcription. There are a couple different kinds of RNA that are made by transcription. We have rRNA that makes ribosomes, at least the major parts of a ribosome. And then we have the messenger RNA. This is a sequence of nucleotides that is directly related to a sequence of amino acids that will then make up a protein. So sometimes we call that the message. The messenger RNA. The message and the messenger RNA are the same thing, but you could actually think of that as like being just a really small dictionary that tells how to spell out one particular protein in a RNA language. All right, so what does the ribosome made out of ribosomal RNA need, right, to make a protein? It needs the message. It needs to know how to spell that protein out properly. But what's it using for letters? What is a ribosome using for letters to spell out a protein word? Another way of asking that is, yeah, what's the building block of a protein? Amino acids, right? So a ribosome needs amino acids in order to make a protein. How does it get amino acids? Because there are little taxi molecules that bring amino acids to a ribosome, and we call those transfer RNAs. So transfer RNAs bring amino acids to the ribosome to be added to a protein as it's growing, as it's being built letter by letter or amino acid by amino acid. Okay. Well, messenger RNA, sometimes, at least in our cells, not in simple cells like bacteria, but in our kinds of cells, eukaryotic cells, starts out as something a little bit different, a much bigger molecule. We call that a pre-messenger RNA. And then pre-messenger RNA is altered in the nucleus to form the messenger RNA that's really needed inside the cytoplasm. So let's look and see how that happens. All right, so here we have DNA. We know that's DNA because why? Double-stranded, sure. Okay, and then it's going to make a pre-messenger RNA right here. And what's the process that makes pre-mRNA? Going from DNA to RNA, that is transcription, and you know where that happens. So that's a really long sequence. But when you look at this pre-messenger RNA, how many different areas does it look like it has? Okay, so I see a light color here and a dark one. I don't know if that's, this might be like a light blue, then a dark blue, right? Two different regions, and here's another region right here, and then there's another dark region, all right, and a light region. All right, so there are different regions within a pre-messenger RNA, and some of these regions are important because they carry information, and other areas are not important, right? These dark areas right here are not important, and they're spliced out, right? They're cut out, and then the light areas then are reassembled into this linear sequence right here. The areas that carry information are what we call exons, information that, as far as we know, is nonsense right here, we call introns. They might have some important function, but so you'll just have to stay tuned over the next 10 or 20 years to find out what's happening in these with these introns right here. All right, so we have a pre-messenger RNA. It has to be modified, right, to make the actual messenger RNA that's being made. All right, so we have, in this particular case, three different exons then that are spliced together. But it doesn't always have to happen that way, because maybe just the first exon and second exon will be spliced together, and then this third exon here might be tossed away. But what could you do? You could take the first exon and the third exon, put them together, you get something different, and this middle part is thrown away. Or any other different kind of combination of these exons, depending on how things are spliced together. All right, so the first understanding of gene expression was, so here is a gene that has transcribed this one pre-messenger RNA molecule. We used to think that for one gene, it would produce one protein molecule. But now we know that this one gene right here could actually make what? One, two, three different kinds of proteins, or one, two, three, and if we put these two together, four, or if we put these two together, that would be a fifth kind of protein, right? Or this one and this one, that would be a sixth kind of protein. So from one gene that makes this pre-messenger RNA molecule, you can produce more than one protein. So what does that mean in terms of the genome and the proteome? So here is a gene. Here is one gene, and all the genes will make up the genome. But is there a one-to-one correspondence between the genome and the proteome? Which one is bigger? Because you can make many more proteins from one gene than one, right? The proteome is a lot bigger than the genome. And that was surprising to a lot of people. Okay. So the human genome has only about 25,000 genes, but we can produce over 100,000 different kinds of proteins. And why is that? Because of how those exons then are spliced together inside the nucleus. And the thing that splices those things together is called the spliceosome. If you ever take a biology class, it gets into that kind of thing. So one gene codes for, at least on average, three different kinds of proteins. And the mechanism that we can state that provides that kind of function, right, or what we can say to explain that is alternative splicing. So the alternative splicing theory tells us why our proteome is a lot bigger than our genome. Okay, so this allows for a given gene to produce several different kinds of messenger RNAs. Okay, so now we have a messenger RNA inside the cytoplasm that's signified by this long line right here. And scooting along that line, that messenger RNA, are a number of these spherical objects, which are ribosomes. And don't forget there's a tunnel in that ribosome that the messenger RNA threads through. And a ribosome will move down the messenger RNA, and as it does, it reads what amino acid should be bound to the previous amino acid. So then the protein gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger as the ribosomes work down that messenger RNA. So whenever we see a messenger RNA loaded up with ribosomes producing many of the same kind of protein over and over again, we call that a polysome. So that's a fairly common kind of thing. So a cell will need, what, many copies of this one kind of protein. All right. So how many different kinds of amino acids? Do we talk about that typically? Do we have the usual kinds? Yeah, there are about 20. Okay, but how many kinds of nucleotides are there in DNA? There's only 4, but you have 20 amino acids. So one nucleotide can't correspond to one amino acid because you only have 4 of them. If you only have 4 amino acids and if a nucleotide was, 4 nucleotides, and if one nucleotide would correspond to one amino acid, then you could make a protein only out of 4 different kinds of amino acids. That wouldn't work. All right, so there has to be a combination of amino acids that will define for one amino acid. And nature has worked out a deal to where there are 3 nucleotides that will determine the position of an amino acid. So in order to understand what letter goes into a protein, you need 3 nucleotides to do that. And this probably is the most amazing slide that's not in your book, but this is probably the most amazing slide in the course. And it just shows that you need a sequence of 3 nucleotides to code for one amino acid within a protein. Okay, so for instance, if there was a certain position where amino acid proline was going to be used to make a protein, then the gene has to have a guanine, guanine, guanine base. All right? And if there's a guanine, cytosine, thyrosine, all right, then that's going to code for arginine. So this is the dictionary. Oh, that's the whole thing right there. I don't have 20 amino acids unless I can scroll down, but you don't need to see all of them. You don't need to memorize this, right? Okay. There are some things that I do want you to know about this. All right. Now, why do I think this is amazing? Because it's not on this slide right here. This is what we call the genetic code. So this tells us what the triplet code is in DNA of nucleotides that will determine an amino acid. But more importantly, not only is it the genetic code, it's the universal genetic code. So it's actually 3 words long, universal genetic code. And when we say universal, what does that mean? Okay, it means that all life forms use this same coding scheme to make a protein. Whether you're a bacterium or an amoeba, orangutan, or a physiology student, or even an anatomy student, right, your body uses the same genetic code. That can be used as evidence, molecular evidence of what? Evolution, right? That we all evolved from very simple life forms that figured this stuff out many millions of years ago, and it proved to be very beneficial, and it never had to be supplanted with anything more efficient or better. All right, so this is very nice evidence of evolution. It doesn't prove evolution. It is what? Just evidence of evolution. Okay, some evidence. So universal genetic code. So here we have DNA. So TAC is DNA. How do you know that's DNA as opposed to AUG over here? And how do you know that's RNA? Because you got thymine over here and uracil over there, right? Okay, so this right here is the messenger RNA sequence. It's going to be AUG, UAG, UUU. This is messenger RNA. So these things, these triplet codes on RNA, are what we call a codon. So a codon is contained within messenger RNA. All right, and these triplet codes over here in DNA, we just call it a DNA triplet. So how do you get from TAC to UAG? What's that process called? That's transcription. That just happens in the nucleus with what? RNA polymerase. That's what does the job. Okay, and then this long string of nucleotides has to leave the nucleus to go into the cytoplasm. A ribosome forms around it, right? That has that nice tunnel on the inside, and then it's going to read these triplet codes. And when it runs into this code, UCC, what is a ribosome going to add to this growing protein? It's going to be a serine amino acid, right? And then it's going to move down to the next triplet, and it's going to add a cysteine amino acid, a different one. Okay. All right, and what's going to bring all these different amino acids to a ribosome so that it can be incorporated in the right location right here? That's the transfer RNA, right? That's the taxi RNA that's doing that. Okay. So here is a really good slide that will kind of put everything together that we talked about. And I understand that what we talked about so far might not make a whole lot of sense until you see the whole big picture. So you're going to have to go back and look at your notes and then forward again and back. You're just going to have to go back and forth in order to synthesize a nice concept, because I just can't say everything all at one time. Okay. But what do we see right here? Something that's easily recognizable. This is DNA, because it's double-stranded, because it has thymine in it, right? Okay. And in order for protein to be made, because that's what we're interested in, is gene expression, what's that first step called? Transcription. Where does it happen? In the nucleus, because the DNA should not leave the nucleus. So this DNA molecule should unzip. RNA polymerase binds to it after a transcription factor binds to some promoter region right here. And one strand will act as the sense strand, the important strand. So we're going to pick one here. Here's a T. That's probably an A. Okay. And then there's a C. So here is the sense strand. So here is the DNA, one strand of the DNA that has been unzipped from this double helix. And then RNA polymerase on this thymine right here is going to base pair an adenine and then a uracil to this adenine and then a guanine to this cytosine right here. And it is going to make a messenger RNA. And then how is messenger RNA going to be read? In a step of three nucleotide base pairs, right? So then AUG is going to be the first codon. And then how would you know what amino acid is going to be added at this location if it's AUG? You have to flip back to your universal genetic code and just look up the code, and then you would know that that's going to be a methionine. So this is what we call codon number one, codon because this is a messenger RNA. So going from DNA to this messenger RNA, you said that was transcription. What do we call it when we use messenger RNA to make a protein? That's translation. And where does that happen? In the cytoplasm on a ribosome someplace. Okay, so I'm not so sure if you've never taken a biology class. This is maybe pretty strange to you, so I'm belaboring this a little bit. If you're really familiar with it, you might be just a little bit bored in class. That just says to people that haven't looked at this scheme yet, once you look at it, it's not too terribly difficult to pick it up. Okay? Okay. So here is the codon on messenger RNA. So we said that the transfer RNA brings amino acids to a ribosome. All right, and translation occurs inside the cytoplasm. Here is a transfer RNA. And transfer RNA has to bind to the messenger RNA. And it does based on base pair rules. So, for instance, let me flip back to the previous slide. All right, here is a codon, AUG. The codon is on messenger RNA. An anticodon on a transfer RNA is going to bind to this region right here. What's the sequence of nucleotides on a transfer RNA that will bind to UAUG? It's got to be UAC, right? And that segment of nucleotides on a transfer RNA is what we call the anticodon. So here is the anticodon, and I see the anticodon UUA. How is this going to bind to a messenger RNA? It's got to be a AAU triplet on a messenger RNA before this transfer RNA will bind to it. And when it binds, it brings along an amino acid that's tacked onto the opposite end of the molecule. So now this amino acid can be added to the protein that's growing off of that ribosome right there. Okay, so what I want you to know is anticodon is located on what kind of molecule? The transfer RNA, the codon, is located on the message. And what's the message? Messenger RNA, right? Messenger RNA. And you can kind of look at that by looking at this slide right here. You can see that happen. I don't know if I have any videos of translation in Blackboard, but there are a lot of really good videos on diffusion and osmosis and active transport, the sodium-potassium pump. So I wouldn't be surprised if I have some really cool videos and quizzes, just practice quizzes on translation as well. All right, so here you see the ribosome, and it's kind of cut open. We're looking into the tunnel. We see the messenger RNA going through it, and it will reveal three nucleotides at one time. That's the triplet code, right? And for instance, here is UCC. I don't know if on that first slide if we had UCC, but then you could determine what amino acid would be added in this location. You need a transfer RNA which has an anticodon of AGG to bind to this region right here. And when the transfer RNA comes in with its amino acid, then it will bind it to the one that's already in this growing protein chain. And then the ribosome is going to move down, right, look at another triplet, and then this protein chain just gets bigger and bigger, one amino acid at a time, determined by a sequence of what? Three nucleotides or a codon on a messenger RNA. So you got anticodons and codons that you should be a little bit aware of. Okay, so there is a pretty big organelle inside the cell that can make proteins, because it binds ribosomes. And what is that right here? This would be a good example of rough endoplasmic reticulum, and here is a ribosome bound to it, and there's a little pore in the endoplasmic reticulum, and as the messenger RNA moves through this ribosome right here, the protein ends up just automatically inside the endoplasmic reticulum. All right, so now it's trapped. What is its fate? What's going to happen to this protein that's being made right here? It's going to be secreted outside the cell, right? It's part of the secretory pathway. It's going to be shipped to the Golgi, and then it's going to be modified, and then shipped via a secretory vesicle to the plasma membrane. Okay, so that's how that functions. So the function of Golgi is to what? Modify and package, exactly right. Modify and package. Okay. DNA replication. Okay, when a cell divides by mitosis, I guess let's write that down. Mitosis, you should know some important parts of mitosis. Like what's the purpose of mitosis? We might actually have to write down really quick what mitosis is. Here we have a cell. Does anybody know how many chromosomes are in a typical human somatic cell, which is like the most of our cells are somatic cells? Yeah, so you have a nucleus with 46 chromosomes. The other kinds of cells that we have in our body are gametes. That's you either have a somatic cell or a gamete that makes your whole body together. And a gamete is, anybody know what a gamete is? That's a sex cell like an oocyte or a sperm. Okay? But all the other cells in your body are what we call somatic cells. They have 46 chromosomes, and sometimes it undergoes a process like this, a part of the cell cycle, where you end up with two cells. These are called daughter cells. This is just a really fast review from anatomy. And how many chromosomes are in each of these daughter cells right here? 46 and 46, and then that's inside the nucleus, and then we can define this process right here as mitosis. So you start with 46 and you end up with two cells with 46. This is right here is what we call the parent cell. Okay, that's the parent cell. So if you're going to take 46 chromosomes and split them in half, how do you get 46 in these two daughter cells? You have to make another copy of the chromosome over here before you split them up. Otherwise, you're going to end up with what, 23 and 23. But these cells, if it's mitosis, should be identical to each other. A daughter cell is identical to a parent cell, and these daughter cells are identical to each other. Nobody's lacking any information right there. So that means that before mitosis takes place, the DNA has to be replicated. That's the term we use. We don't say duplicated, but it has to be replicated. You need another copy of it so that both of those daughter cells get a copy of it. All right, so when cells divide, DNA replicates itself, and identical copies go to the two daughter cells. Well, what was my question? Oh, what's the purpose of mitosis? You should know that. It's got two things. That's right. Growth and replacement of old and damaged cells. So growth is really important because how did we all start out as an organism? What were we at one time? We were just a single cell, which you call a zygote, right? And that's not a very interesting stage of life. Why is that not so interesting? Because you can't come to physiology class and take notes if you're just a single cell, right? You need to have trillions of cells in order to do that. So how do you go from a zygote to trillions of cells like you are right now? That's a process of mitosis. So that's what we call growth. But the cells that you have in your body right now are not the cells that you had even 10 seconds ago, because cells die all the time and they have to be replaced. For instance, red blood cells are notorious because they only live for about 120 days, all right? And then they have to be replaced. So how many red blood cells do you lose every second in your body? About 2 million. 2 million die every second, all right? And if you start to run low on red blood cells, that's a clinical disease that we call anemia. So what prevents you from becoming anemic if you lose 2 million red blood cells every second? You have to build 2 million red blood cells every second through this process over here that we call mitosis. A little bit more complicated than that, but that's pretty close, right? So you're busy building 2 million red blood cells, but that still can't be used as a reason why you couldn't study for a test or get the online quiz done at a certain time because you were busy. I know we're all very busy, okay? Okay, that's just something that goes on in the background, okay? All right, so DNA replication, how does that happen? Now, what kind of molecule is DNA? It's a double helix, right? It's actually two molecules put together with hydrogen bonds, and just like transcription, it has to unwind and unzip. And there's a molecule right here called a helicase. It breaks those hydrogen bonds, produces two free strands of DNA so that we can look at the sequence of nucleotides or the bases on the inside of the double helix. And a polymerase is going to be used. A polymerase is an enzyme because of the ASE right here at the end of the word. And it's not going to make RNA because then we'd have to call it an RNA polymerase. We call this a DNA polymerase because it's going to make a DNA polymer, right? So DNA polymerase binds to each strand and makes a new complementary copy of the old strand using the old DNA base pair rules, ATGC. All right, and so we call this process semi-conservative replication. And I'll show you a picture of why we call it semi-conservative. So here is a good picture that's in your book. We start out with a nice double helix, right? So this is the old chromosome. And in order for mitosis to take place, what do we need? We need another copy of that so it can split into two. So the helicase unzips it. And then it starts to add. So here are two old strands, right? So here's an old strand right here. And you can see that we never break the original strand of DNA, either this one over here or this one over here. We never break it. We just what? Unzip it. And then the DNA polymerase starts to add nucleotides at these locations. So the polymerase at this guanine right here will add a cytosine just by the usual base pair rules. Okay. So the old DNA is used as a template to make a new strand of DNA. Right, the new complementary strand. So what do we end up with? We got two copies of the original DNA molecule because we're using both strands as a template. So there's high fidelity in this replication process. So what do we end up with? Two new chromosomes, but the new chromosome has what? An old strand, one complete old strand, and one complete new strand of DNA. And the other chromosome has what? One complete old strand of DNA and one complete new strand. And so that's what we call semi-conservative. If it was fully conservative, we would end up with two chromosomes, one with what? Two old strands and two new strands. But it can't work that way because we need to use one old strand as a template to make an exact copy of the other strand. Does that make sense? Semi-conservative replication. All right, so that's what we mean by semi-conservative, and the enzyme that does that is the DNA polymerase. Cell cycle, you guys are all familiar with this. Okay, so I'm not going to talk much about mitosis because it's just a nice review. But here is a pretty good example of the whole cell cycle. Okay, mitosis is just a small part of the cell cycle. This is the whole cell cycle right here. Most of the time, the cell is in which phase of the cell cycle? Is it? It's in interphase. Right? What maybe you didn't learn in anatomy is that interphase even has different phases associated with it. It's got G1, S, and G2 right here. All right, the first part, we have some centrioles replicating and other kinds of organelles replicating. And what do we mean by replication? You've got one, and now you get more than one. You've got many, right? Okay, so organelles are replicated. In the middle part of interphase, DNA is replicated like we just talked about. What's the term we use for DNA replication to describe how it happens? It's semi-conservative replication. That happens in the S phase. And then G2 right here has some stop sequences that check to make sure that all of these processes happened in the correct order before mitosis really takes place, because the cell doesn't want to undergo mitosis if DNA replication isn't complete or if it doesn't have the right number of organelles before mitosis begins. So this is the final growth and checkpoint before mitosis takes place, so we call that G2. And then we've got what? Prophase, metaphase, anaphase, and telophase. These are the active parts of mitosis. Prophase, you should know some things about. What happens to the DNA during prophase? It goes from an active form to an inactive form. The active form is what we call extended chromatin. The inactive form is condensed into a chromosome that you can see even underneath a light microscope, right? So prophase, we have condensation of chromatin. What do we have? So we have extended chromatin being condensed into a chromosome, but don't forget, you've got two copies of that one chromosome connected right here at the centromere. Extended versus condensed chromatin, that happens during prophase. What else do we have right here? The nuclear envelope starts to disappear. Centrioles start to migrate to opposite poles of the cell. That happens during prophase, and you can see chromosomes now. Oh, you can see the centrioles moving. All right, metaphase is the easiest phase to see. The chromosomes are all lined up on the equator of the cell. Now, how does that happen? How do these chromosomes move around? Do they have like cilia, paddles, oars, or what's happening? What's going on there? The spindle apparatus is involved. The spindle apparatus has components made up of microtubules. And remember, microtubules are like a railway station, a railroad system inside the cell, monorails. Organelles and even chromosomes can hop a ride on a microtubule, and they're going to push and pull these chromosomes so they line up exactly on the equator. And it's controlled by the centrioles right here. So the centrioles organize all that. That's metaphase. And then the sister chromatids, I don't know if that's on this slide right here. So here is one copy of a chromosome. Here's the replicated copy. We call these sister chromatids. So during anaphase, the sister chromatids separate and get pulled to opposite poles of the cell right after they hop a ride on those microtubules. So we got metaphase, and then anaphase, the sister chromatids separate, and now we don't have sister chromatids anymore. We have daughter chromatids. Right? And daughter chromatids are going to end up in the two daughter cells eventually. All right? And so when these chromosomes are pulled all the way over to the centromere right here, then a cleavage furrow is going to develop between the right at the equator of the cell, and then we would call that telophase. And guess what telo means? It means end. It means the end of something. Right? It could be the tip of something, like the tip of a pencil would be a telomere. Okay, telophase is just the end phase of mitosis, and this cleavage furrow then separates cytoplasm into two separate daughter cells, and that process has a name too. Separation of cytoplasm into two separate cells is what we call cytokinesis, right? Cyto is cell, kinesis is the movement of the cell into two separate daughter cells. All right, and what's the difference between this daughter cell right here and this daughter cell right here? Nothing. They're like clones of each other. And what's the difference between this daughter cell and the parent cell? Nothing. Identical, right? Mitosis is what we call asexual reproduction, which just produces the same thing over and over and over again. which, if you look around the room, do you see another you in the room? Were you replicated by asexual processes? No. Because everybody's different, you were produced by what kind of process? Sexual reproduction, right? Not asexual reproduction. All right, so central mirrors, we talked about telomeres are just the tips of a chromosome, and every time a cell undergoes mitosis, a little bit of a telomere is clipped off. Sometimes it's repaired, but sooner or later, a chromosome gets so short that it can't undergo replication, and then what happens to that cell? It actually dies. And that's a very important process in our body. Cells do have to die, right? Otherwise, they build up and maybe form a tumor. Okay, certain cells have to die, and then they're replaced naturally by the process of mitosis. Okay, because as cells live long, they age and start to misbehave. Meiosis. Oh, I didn't know that was in here. Do you have that in your notes? No. Okay. We're going to talk about meiosis at the end of this semester. All right. So do you have any questions about the test? The sign-in sheet is going around. You got to make sure you know the difference between an active process and a passive process. All right. Which way molecules move, which requires energy. I didn't use an analogy that is really helpful. I've talked to a lot of students that were still a little bit confused about active versus passive process. And maybe I want to draw it on the board really quick. Okay? Okay. So I know when I was in college, I was really fortunate because I had a car. But I bought this car for about $100. So it wasn't really all that good of a car. But it was pretty cool. It was like a 1960 MGB, which was, you know, it's about this long, nice four-cylinder engine, very light, very cheap to operate, except for the repairs that I had to do. But I couldn't always tell if I would be able to start my car after school or after work. Okay, and it was a sports car, so it had a nice shift, really nice short throw shift to it. So if I wasn't sure that I was able to start my car, so here's my car right here, it was about that size, where would I always park? Would I park on top of a hill or on a flat piece of ground or at the bottom of a hill? I always parked at the top of a hill because even though maybe the battery was dead or the starter motor wouldn't work or the ignition key wouldn't turn the engine over or something wouldn't work, what could I do to my car? I could just sit in the driver's seat, right, put it in second gear and put the clutch in, and then with my left foot just give it a little push because it was a really light car, and I could get it to roll down the hill. Now, would I need gasoline to get it to roll down the hill? No. Okay, so is that an active process of my car moving down the hill, rolling down, or passive? Passive. Right, so going from high to low is a nice passive process, does not require energy. And then as I was rolling down the hill, I popped the clutch and then I could drive home. That was really sweet. Okay? All right, so going from high to low is what? Passive. That's a passive process. But now let's just say my car is down here. What do I need to get up on top of the hill? Does it happen automatically? Absolutely not. To go from low to high, and you could think what? Low to high concentration. All right, going from low to high, that's an active process. And what do you need to do that? What did this car need? It needed ATP, right, if you make the analogy to your body. All right, so that's an active process. So think of that always. All right, so if it's an active process, molecules are going from low to high, but now you got a couple different kinds of active processes. All right, maybe you got two different kinds. You got one kind right here, and you got another kind right here. And let's just put ATP in this box over here, and let's just put gradient over in this box. These are both active processes, which means what? Molecules are going to do what? Move from low concentration to high. But now, what are these two boxes? Well, how would we label these two boxes? They're both active transport, but ATP, if you see a diagram with ATP, what is that? It's active transport, but what kind of active transport? This is primary, right? And then what is this? You still need energy, but not in the form of ATP, but in the form of some kind of chemical gradient, maybe across a membrane. So what do we call this kind of active transport? This would then be secondary. That's secondary active transport. Okay, and then furthermore, we can break secondary active transport down into two forms. It's going to use a gradient of a molecule, so to drag along another molecule in a certain direction. What happens, let's just say that this is a nice membrane right here. What do we call it when two molecules go in the same direction? One is going from high to low, but the other one is going from low to high. So this requires energy. It's going to use the energy in this gradient right here to do that. What do we call that if they're both going in the same direction? This is symport. All right, so symport is what kind of active transport? Symport is a secondary active transport because we don't see any ATP. But what if the two molecules that are moving are like that in opposite directions? That's what we call antiport. Okay? There's another couple words in your book, antiport, right there. So antiport and symport are kind of secondary active transport. They're using a gradient to move things from low to high. Okay, primary active transport, something will move from low to high, but what do we have to put in here? Energy in the form of ATP being hydrolyzed to what? ADP plus inorganic phosphate. Okay, so think of those things. Organize it like that in your mind. And then you got some really nice diagrams. If you don't see how these membrane proteins kind of work, a good model for looking at how these membrane proteins work, you have good videos in Blackboard. Okay, look at some active transport. Look at the sodium-potassium pump video in Blackboard. Okay, so you need a picture ID. You need a good eraser and a pencil next time, please. And a Scantron. Don't forget the 882.